Welcome to the Real Estate Strategies Podcast, where we host in-depth conversations on everything real estate with the industry's biggest movers and shakers. I'm your host, Ken McElroy. Let's get right into this episode.
Hey, everybody. I'm here with Keith Weinhold. Welcome back.
Hey, it's so good to be here. It's interesting. I was last here in January of 2021. And remember, Ken, that's when we talked about how you can profit from inflation. Inflation was only 1.5% back then. So for all the viewers and listeners, had they watched that, they really would have profited from that surge of inflation.
We should go back and check that one out again, you know, because I remember that discussion was fabulous. And now that's kind of the hot topic for sure. And so Keith has a great company. It's called Get Rich Education, right?
That's right.
And before we go down that road, let's talk about how you started, because most people, you know, they struggle with just getting started. I know you started with a fourplex.
Yes. And, you know, this is something very actionable for you, the listener, the viewer there. You can start off like I did. I didn't have a lot of money when I started out. I think that's a common investor story. So how could I do more with less? And, you know, I was in Anchorage, Alaska at the time when I was about to buy my first fourplex building. And I didn't have the inclination to know how to remodel places or be a landlord or anything like that. And you know, Ken, it's a quote we've all heard, but it bears repeating. The circle of friends I had fallen in with harkens the Jim Rohn quote, "You are the average of the five people that you spend the most time with." Take your five closest friends' income level, take their educational attainment level, take the way they dress, your five closest friends. If you want to change yourself, change your five. And two of my five in Anchorage were what I call pretty aspirational guys. And two of my friends, they had made their first ever property a fourplex building with just a 3.5% down payment. So I learned how to do this from them.
Okay.
And you can still do this today. All you have to do is live in one of the units at least 12 months and just have a minimum credit score of 580. You can do that with a single family home, duplex, triplex, or fourplex. That's how you can start with a bang and a small down payment.
Yeah, we call that house hacking,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we talk a lot about this, and I don't think people really realize, you know, and if you move into one side of a duplex and you buy a duplex with this low money down and the lower credit score, you're basically, you might not have a lot of cash flow if you live in the other side, but what you are is you're eliminating that huge expense that might have been for rent or something else, right?
That's right, 100%. And, you know, everybody has their wacky landlord story. So I bought my first property living in one unit of the fourplex, renting out the other three, and like a duplex, like you said, where you might live.
Did you tell me you were the owner? Because that's always my little thing.
Yeah, you know, after a while, after I got new tenants in there, actually after I had moved off site to another place, I didn't really want to admit I'm the owner. They asked all kinds of crazy things. But, you know, everything didn't go perfectly. For example, you know, shortly after I moved in, it was time for a tenant to pay the rent. It was the first that was due. They said they'd pay it the fifth. I was like, oh, yeah, sure. Okay, whatever. Well, of course they didn't. I had to replace them. And you know how I qualified my next tenant in that vacant unit?
What the
qualifications were? Three females applied. They were attractive. So I let them move into the unit next to me based primarily on the fact that they were attractive. Well, that didn't work out very well. They had parties and they did not invite their landlord to the party. So everyone's got their wacky landlord story. That's mine. But that's how you can start big.
It is a good way to do it. And I don't think a lot of people realize that they can do that. So a lot of people I know are struggling with these affordability issues. So, you know, we've seen since our last podcast, you and I did, we've seen massive inflation, massive rent growth, obviously massive interest rate growth, which has driven people's mortgages up and driven people's mortgage payments up. Plus, we have all the inflationary components that I just mentioned. This is the best time to look at that house hack model because, you know, why wouldn't you grow with inflation if you can do it with a two-unit or a four-unit, right? Now, there are some restrictions for four units and under, right? Isn't there something where if you go over that, it's a different kind of loan?
That's right. Four units is the most you can do with that FHA loan and 3.5% down. So it's single-family home, duplex, triplex, or fourplex. And if you have VA, Veterans Administration benefits, you can use that same plan with zero down, believe it or not. It's a great way to start with a bank.
Yeah, so you guys really need to look into this. If you could replace your living expenses, the largest one, which is obviously typically rent and utilities and all that, then why wouldn't you, right?
Yeah. And, you know, here's the thing. Here's the takeaway. And I didn't understand this until I had owned that first for a couple years, I think we've all learned and we've all been influenced by the mantra that you don't want to invest with your money. You can build wealth profoundly by ethically employing other people's money. We're talking about doing it ethically, providing people with housing that's clean, safe, affordable, and functional. With that fourplex, like I just described, I was using other people's money three ways at the same time, and you can do it too, because I use the bank's money for the loan and leverage. I use the tenant's money for the income that you were just talking about to offset all the building expenses and the mortgage payments. And then thirdly, I was using the government's money for very generous tax incentives. Use other people's money three ways at the same time with a loan for income property. That's really going to accelerate your wealth building.
That's right. That's right. And can you, with that, also do it with the down payment? That might be a fourth way.
There are creative ways. For example, I know with FHA, sometimes you can get a gift. So that's a very astute question.
Yeah. So that's another thing that a lot of people don't think about is, you know, I know with the FHA program, they're going to be looking at you, but there are ways to get gifts.
That's right. And really use other people's money for the entire thing.
Did I just give Keith a fourth way?
Indeed. Yeah. Four ways. Keep using other people's money all that you can.
The point is, guys, it all can be OPM or other people's money. And that is the point. And so if you can't look into that, then it's now just an excuse. So let's talk about, like, you're in Alaska and you've done a very successful job of going out of state, out of the network and buying real estate. How have you done that? Because a lot of people are freaking out around, you know, how do I stay local? Do I go out of state? And there's a lot of things to consider.
I don't invest in my own local market. In fact, Ken, I sold my last local, meaning local to Anchorage, Alaska. I sold my last local apartment building last year. It's the first time in 20 years since I bought that first fourplex building. I don't own any local properties. I do all my investing out of state in investor advantage markets in the Midwest and South. And I know to some people, it's scary to go out of state for the first time. You know, for some reason with stocks, people feel quite comfortable with, you know, buying stock for a company. They don't even know where that company's headquartered. But with real estate and something called turnkey real estate investing, that's one way to go across state lines. But really, here's my mindset in getting comfortable with out-of-state investing. This is how I think of it, Ken. The property is only the fourth most important thing in real estate investing. And if you're thinking about investing, you often start by thinking about, okay, well, what would my next property be? It's important, but there are three things more important. Number one is you. What do you want real estate to do for you? This is what I like to share with people, Ken. Secondly is, what market are you in? Thirdly, what's the team of professionals, especially your property manager, that you choose to surround yourself with? And then fourthly, and only fourthly, is the property. So let's go through that. It starts with you. What do you want real estate to do for you? Are you looking for cash flow, which is common, or appreciation, or tax advantages, or a lifestyle benefit, like maybe you want to live in it yourself? Once you've got that figured out, what you want real estate to do for you, the market is the next most important thing. There is more risk with being in a little ho-dunk market of 6,000 people where half the employment is tied to the zinc mine than you think. So I like to be in larger metros. Yeah. We have a diversification of economic sectors, something that you really excel in, Ken. So the market's that second thing, because you need to have a place that's going to be filled with tenants. And when you buy your property, you need to have a reasonable expectation that 18 months down the road, you're going to have another tenant that's going to be able to come in and fill that property. And then the third most important thing is the manager, your team. I mean, a bad property manager would drive a good property into the ground, because you want this to be relatively passive. And fourthly, and only fourthly, is that property. And you know what happens, Ken? I see this happen so often. People get it 100% backwards. They go 4-3-2-1. First, they get all excited about a property and buy it because it has pretty blue shutters. Then they try to figure out if there's a good manager in the market because they don't like to get texts from tenants. And then secondly, they try to figure out the market that they bought in, and it's too late. And then they go back to number one, which is you, which you're just so far out of line. And this is why a lot of people say that real estate doesn't work. So again, the property is only the fourth most important thing. It starts with you, market, and team first.
Yeah, I find that if they're lucky, they do go 4-3-2-1 all the time.
Right.
It drives me nuts because, you know, as you know, and most professionals go 1-2-3-4. And I think what happens is, if when they get to one, they're figuring it out. You know, you need to start there because it certainly clears up the vision, right?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, you intrinsically know this, but you just haven't thought it through before. Like, for example, you already know that the market is more important than the property. A giant mansion in a swamp outside Charleston, West Virginia is not worth much, but yet a tiny 400-square-foot efficiency apartment in the Tribeca neighborhood of Manhattan can be worth an awful lot. It just reinforces the fact that the market's more important than the property, and a lot of people get it wrong.
It always has been, and it always will be, you know, because you can screw up a purchase in a market that's going like this,
yeah,
and you'll still look like a star.
Yeah, and this will be true a decade and maybe even a century.
Yeah,
from now.
Yeah, so that's why the market's so important. So let's talk about the most controversial thing here, which is why there's 100% certainty, 100%
yep,
of a housing crash. This is I heard you talk about this, and we talked a little bit about it for the podcast. I said, let's just wait. Let's talk about it on the podcast.
There is a 100% certainty of a housing crash. And one might be wondering, first of all, how could you say that? No one has complete clairvoyance to know the future. And the reason there's a 100% certainty of a housing crash in this era is because it already occurred. It happened in April of 2020, more than 3 years ago. It was a housing supply crash, not a price crash. And in fact, the fact that we have had a supply crash really hedges against any sort of price crash. So using Freddie Mac data, and I shared the chart with you before I came over to the studio here so that you could see the backup. There are so many ways to go ahead and measure the available supply of homes, but about 1.5 million is what you'll see Fred, the Federal Reserve real estate data, or rather Federal Reserve economic data, about 1.5 million has historically been the amount of available homes going back to 2016. It began to fall after that. With what happened in the health crisis, it plummeted in April of 2020 to 600,000 units. And it still hasn't rebounded, and it's continued to fall. So it's a 60% supply crash, 1.5 million down to less than 600,000 now. And that's what hedges against a price crash. That's why prices are continuing to stay buoyant. At whatever demand level, the supply is really low, and that helps keep a bid on property. And really, I'd like to share with you the profundity of the fact that we've had a supply crash, not a price crash. I mean, think about this. We're the most powerful nation in the world by so many measures. We're the most powerful nation as far as political positioning and our military and our currency and our brand. The most powerful nation in the world. And we have trouble housing our own people. I mean, we're talking about food, shelter, safety, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, base level stuff here. So it's actually a bigger deal then a price crash, if you think about it. You may very well see more homeless people in your hometown, for example. So the crash already occurred, a supply crash, not a price crash.
Yeah, it's an important distinction. And I think people really need to back up from this a little bit and understand where things are headed. You know, we have affordability problems. We definitely have homelessness issues creeping up. And so what really, really challenged everybody were these federal funds increases and interest rates that went up. So all of a sudden, you know, we've also had the largest delta between rents and the average mortgage price. So you got mortgages here. So rents and mortgages were kind of trending along at a pretty equal amount, but now because of the home prices that went up and the interest rates went up, there's a big gap between rents, even though rents have gone up. So that's also keeping people in their houses because they've got the 6%, let's say 5-6% interest rates, but they bought them at 3%. So they have this trapped equity, right? So if you own a home that's 500 grand and you have 3% on it, you're not going to move, right?
No, it's the mortgage interest rate lock-in effect.
Yeah.
And that's a really astute point, Ken, because this plays in to the national dearth of supply. I talked
Correct.
About 1.5 million available units down to 600,000. I talked to just lay people and everyday homeowners that have become landlords because they say, I don't want to sell my home at its 3.25% interest rate. So when I move out of it, I just want to hold on to that loan and rent it out. In the United States, you can't move your mortgage along with your property like that. So it's that interest rate lock-in effect. That property, rather than coming up for sale, which would increase supply, doesn't. It stays put. And almost two-thirds of mortgage borrowers in the United States have a mortgage rate of 4% or less.
That's a staggering number.
It is.
So I always tell people, Keith, when I was growing up, cash was an asset,
right?
That was a liability, but now it's the opposite. Cash is now a liability because inflation, if you have it in the bank, is running faster and harder than what you're getting in interest. And now that debt at 3%, let's say, is an asset. You would actually be selling the property and you'd be getting rid of that asset. You can't borrow at 3% today because that is OPM or other people's money like we talked about, right?
Right. And if I borrow from a bank, say I'm a borrower and I want to take a loan from you, well, of course, if I can do that at an interest rate that's less than the rate of inflation, I want to do that because it's profitable. And how the mechanics of that work actually is when I repay Ken, the bank in this case, every month, that dollar debases on him faster than his interest can accrue on me. That's profitable for you if you can find that. It's getting a little harder to find, but you can, in some situations, still get interest rates lower than inflation. And inflation is such a foofy number. We know that the CPI is manipulated with substitution and weighting and things, but if you can borrow at less than real inflation, that's exactly the transaction you're profiting from.
What do you think real inflation is? Because I'm all over the internet trying to figure this out, and I go to all the shadow stats and all the things.
Yeah, that's good that you're on shadow stats. There isn't really a good, accurate way to measure inflation. I mean, Ken and I, if we're next door neighbors, we're going to pay different rates of inflation. Say one of us is a vegetarian and the other eats meat, then inflation in the price of steak affects one of us, but not the other. So if he commutes more than I do, gasoline prices affect him more than me. It's very difficult to pin down what the real rate of inflation is. There are hedonic reasons as well. Hedonic means pleasure seeking. So, for example, if home values go up 10% in a year, but now it's more common for homes to have quartz countertops in them a year later and they didn't have that in the homes of yesteryear, how do you adjust inflation for that? Because you're getting a better standard of living with quartz countertops. So this is why Ken and anyone has such a hard time pinning it down to what's the real inflation number. It's really nebulous and slippery.
I do know it's more.
We do know it's more than what the CPI is reporting. How much more? No one knows.
I know. It's true. It's all over the map. But I got to tell you, man, things are creeping up. We were, my wife and I were, we just go to dinner and it's $100 now. I mean, there's all these things that are, there are a lot more. But one thing is for sure, guys, if you can have an interest rate less than inflation, you're beating the market. That's the important thing to understand. And that's why, going way back to Rich Dad Poor Dad with Kiyosaki, he was way ahead of his time when he said, cash is trash and, savers are losers. And he doesn't mean that you're a loser. What he means is savers are losing money as compared with inflation. Back then, it was, 2%. So now it's obviously more, right?
Yeah. And, really with inflation, I think the word is noticeable. No one talked about it when it was about 2% these past few years, when it was right around the Fed target. It isn't until it became noticeable that it really became a thing. And, what do they say? What's the Walmart greeter say? They no longer say hello at the door. Instead, they just apologize for what's about to happen to you in there. It's noticeable.
I noticed I was digging into the CPI or the Consumer Price Index recently for a video I was doing. And I saw that housing was 44% of that number.
Yeah, between rent and owner's equivalent rent. Those two measures contribute to the CPI.
So that's a lot. So think about that. Because I know, what does that mean? To me, that means that the Fed is not done increasing rates. Because, even I guess now they're reporting it at 5. But if 44% of that 5% is housing, in theory, then it looks to me like they're gonna clip away at more of these federal funds rates, right? What do you think?
That's right. A lot of people think the Fed pivot will come later this year. The Fed pivot means when they stop hiking, which is increasing rates, and begin to lower rates. I've got something really, almost pretty trippy, really, on interest rates to share with your audience here, Ken, because I think this is a real paradox that's going to blow some people away.
What is it?
So we know that mortgage interest rates have been up so much lately, and you know what happens with rising mortgage rates, right? When mortgage rates rise, home prices, you thought I was going to say fall, didn't you? No, when mortgage rates rise, expect home prices to rise. And you might say, what? That turns my whole world upside down. I mean, wouldn't one know that when mortgage rates rise, well, that decreases affordability, so one would afford less and prices would need to come down? And you know the lens I like to look through a lot of times, Ken, when we talk about applying economics to real estate? It's what I call history over hunches. I think it's really easy to have a hunch that when mortgage rates rise, well, obviously prices would have to come down due to impeded affordability. So maybe you're still wondering, well, in what kind of upside down world would that happen? It's the world that you've been living in these past 2 years. What happened in 2021 and 2022? Home prices rose at a torrid pace, about 20% in 2021. And the following year, last year, another 10%, way beyond historic norms. And what happened with interest rates during that same time? They about doubled. I mean, they climbed a cliff. So that actually usually happens, that when rates rise, prices rise. In fact, in the history over hunches vein, Winston Churchill is the one that said, the further you look into the past, the further you can see into the future. So let's open this up and look at the past, talk about why this happens, and then think about some lessons that you can learn from it. So in about the last 30 years, since 1994, mortgage rates have increased substantially 9 times. That's defined as a mortgage rate increase of 1% or more. And during those 9 times that mortgage rates rose, home prices rose 7 of those 9 times. This typically happens. And you know, when I share this with real estate people, Ken, a lot of them are blown away. They don't understand how they really don't even believe it. And I shared the data with you right before I came over here to the studio. And maybe you can even put that chart up there to show people that.
Yeah, we'll do that, Jerry.
Yeah. But you know what? When I talk with doctors of economics, like ones that I interview on my show, some of them aren't aware of it, but they all say, oh yeah, I can believe it. I can understand how that would happen. All right, so what's going on here? Why does this happen? Why, when mortgage rates rise, would home prices rise? And, you know, they're for a couple of reasons. You know, Ken, you and Danil talk so eloquently about lag effects in the economy.
Yep.
So that's one reason, but this can't completely be explained by lag effects, because we have to think about what makes a person buy a home, okay? We'll come back to that in a moment, but let's think about what happens when rates rise. Okay, generally, the Fed is saying that the economy's hot. People are employed. Right now, there are some high-profile tech layoffs for sure, but there are still more open job positions than there even are people to fill them. And this makes inflationary pressures heat up, so that's why they raise rates. Well, when everyone has a job and you have an option, if you get laid off, to go to a second job, and employers are competing for employees, what happens? You feel pretty secure in your job. And what do you do when you feel secure in your job? You're likely to buy a home. So your situation, your income, your job security is an even more important factor than what mortgage rates are. So this is why, completely counterintuitively and paradoxically, when mortgage rates rise, expect home prices to rise as well. And in fact, Ken, the only 2 times in the last 9 that rates rose that prices didn't rise as well, you know where they were? They were 2007 and 2008, when there were really wacky aberrations going on in the market leading up to the global financial crisis. So again, when rates rise, prices typically do too, completely opposite of what most think.
Yeah, and don't forget that part of the reason rates rise is because of the scarcity. So when you go from 1.4 million to 600,000,
yeah,
you have less, just basic demand and supply, less supply.
That's right. And I think importantly, one needs to remember that there's less supply of both homes to buy and homes to rent. And even when one does want to buy and they continue to get shut out of the market with higher rates and higher prices, that obviously puts more people back in the renter pool, which is pretty good for guys like you and I, Ken, that own a lot of income property.
That's right. That's why I did that video, Renter Nation, because it's not good, by the way. This, you know, housing is supposed to be balanced. So as somebody who owns a lot of rentals, we lose people. We lose people to single-family home buying. That is the way it's supposed to be, right? And then there's some people that, you know, when they're done with the single-family side, they want to come to rentals for convenience, for flexibility, for all kinds of things. So it's a natural step. And so when one's out of whack or the other's out of whack, it's not necessarily good.
No, it's not good. I mean, that impedes the upward mobility and really part of the American dream. Of course, you never want to lose a tenant from one of your apartments, but at least you can say, hey, congratulations, you moved up a rung or whatever. So just the cost of any entry-level housing is really high. And in fact, when you parse the amount of available homes by the entry-level type of, say, single-family homes and duplexes, which tend to be the ones that make the best rentals, they're even more scarce.
Yeah, it's gotten worse. You know, I don't know that as a builder, as you know, we can't build entry-level, you know.
The most can't make it feasible.
The cost to build a house today is expensive.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, if you are looking to be a real estate investor in the 1 to 4 unit space, which is really an area where I specialize, if you can find a builder that builds entry-level homes, I do know of a number of them in the Midwest and South, this could be a time for you to get a new build rental property more so than a renovated one. You know, that's really opposite of 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were still coming off the global financial crisis. Crazy that was.
Yeah.
When the cost of property was even less than the replacement cost, no one was going to build. Now you do have people building. And, you know, Ken, I know a number of these builders, because mortgage rates are higher, that they're helping the investor, the individual investor.
Buy down the rate.
People like me. Yeah, they're buying down the rate. So it's quite common for, say on a $350,000 property, for the builder to give you 2% of that $350,000 purchase price. What is that? $7,000 at the closing table for you to buy down your mortgage rate. You also have turnkey new build companies that are giving 1 to 2 years of free property management. So new build typically costs more than renovated, which is why in the past, a lot of investors like to buy a renovated property. But with the new builds and incentives like that, and the fact that you're probably going to have lower insurance rates with new builds versus renovateds, I think this really tilts toward you as the investors looking to add property to your portfolio. It makes more sense now to look at new build than it has at any time in the recent past.
Yeah, I know that, like, when we look at those big projects for acquisition, you know, we're looking at what is the cost per unit for, let's say, an acquisition in Phoenix versus building one. And in the last 3 years, it was building all day long because the cost was $100,000 more per unit to buy. Crazy, crazy how existing product can get pushed up that high. And so all of a sudden, that makes the building more affordable. Yeah, actually, and when you build the one next to the other, people are going to want the newer product all day long.
Yeah, Ken, and maybe I can ask you a little something, being a builder. You know, I have learned from some builders that, in a way, some things are nice because they're not getting as much competition from resales on the market. We talked about why there aren't resales on the market. People want to hold on to their low mortgage rates, so builders don't have the competition that way. But maybe you could let me know. Of course, it's going to vary by region. And we've been talking very much nationally so far in the conversation here. But really, what's the lowest price point where it's still feasible as a builder to build, where you have enough margin? Like, what's the lowest price point on maybe a single family home and then
sort
of larger?
Yeah. So for me, it's mostly just apartments. So, you know, we'll go into a market. I'll give you a great example. We can buy in Austin, Texas, mid-90s product. Vaulted ceilings, 9-foot ceilings, beautiful garages for $180,000 a door. Really nice. There's no way we can build that there for that price, not even close. However, you take that exact project and you move it to Phoenix, it's $350,000. Now, the rents are different, the expenses are different, the insurance is different, the property taxes are different. I understand the math isn't the same, but on a per foot basis and a per unit basis, that's how different it is. So because of that, we're building in Arizona and buying in Texas. So now that can change also, you know, that Austin could get really hot. Those prices can go up. And then we, you know, that it would change that dynamic. And so to your point, you always have to take a look at the difference between the deliverable, you know, do you buy? The one thing I do like about buying is that it's immediate, you know, you could step into something immediate, make change immediate, whereas there's a big lag with the construction. So you do have some interest rate risk because you can't get a fixed rate loan on something that doesn't exist. It's land, it's air, and then it's built until it's in the service, they call it. Then you can put fixed debt on it, but that's it. Up to that point, you're subject to a little bit of the whim of the fluctuations of the Fed and all the other things that determine interest rates. So you do have those things. So they're a little, but we do love the new properties and so do our tenants. So when you build something new, people want to be there. And they move out of that 10-year or 15-year-old product into something new. So there is that, plus you get a little bit more rent and, you know, all of those things. So there's positives and negatives for both.
And so it's really, I'd say in the last 10 years, when you've seen the advent and proliferation of these build-to-rent companies, they're turnkey companies that build a finished product for you. That's the first thing that they do. And then the second thing they do is they place a tenant in it for you. And then thirdly, they hold it under management for you, the investor, if you so choose. Basically, it's those three things that define what a turnkey rental property is. So it's making more and more sense to do that with new build properties.
Yeah, it certainly can. It's market by market, but you're right. You have to look at it each and every time. So, before we wrap up, I'd like to talk about, you know, you always say invest in what's scarce, which I completely agree with. You know, and the other thing I like to say is invest in things that you can't print. So, you know, you can print dollars, you know, you can create a stock or ETF out of gold and all kinds of things, but you can't print gold, you can't print oil, you can't print trees, you can't print real estate. So let's talk about what's invest in what's scarce. So what do you mean by that?
Oh, I love that. And we're so aligned on that. If I have any one investing theme, it comes down to one word, scarcity. Yeah, I like to invest in what's scarce, not what's abundant and can be printed. You know, you don't even have to print anymore. It's just a few keystrokes. And things like dollars and additional stock shares, abundant things, they can just be conjured into existence. So I avoid what's abundant, like dollars and stocks. And I focus on investing in what's scarce and is difficult to produce more of and take real world resources to produce, which is real for me. It's real estate, gold, and Bitcoin. That rounds out my scarcity theme. Why real estate? It's a wealth builder. Really, gold and Bitcoin are not proven wealth builders. I think gold and Bitcoin are maybe good places to move some capital once you've built it. Gold and Bitcoin can be good stores of value. Gold, really the classic store of value, and Bitcoin, the real risk. But yeah, real world resources to produce, they're all scarce. Like we talked about the low supply of real estate. It has utility, meaning usefulness. And yeah, when you buy a piece of real estate, a lot of people don't think about it this way, but break down all the commodities that you're buying when you buy a piece of real estate, from drywall to gypsum to copper wire to glass and all those sorts of things. It takes real world resources to produce that real estate. Real estate gives you advantages that gold and Bitcoin don't, like a reliable income stream and the ability to use leverage and terrific tax advantages. So that's why I'm a real estate guy. That's scarce. Gold has a scarcity. What's really special about gold is it's one of the few things that's had enduring value for millennia, about 5,000 years. You can say that about exceedingly few things. I guess you could make jokes about its intrinsic value. It's really not used that much industrially, but people have always flocked and gravitated toward that during times of uncertainty. And there's low supply inflation on gold. It is very difficult to mine 2% more gold than it was the previous year. There are just challenges from exploration to mining in creating much more of this gold. And then thirdly, Bitcoin. You might not be that familiar with Bitcoin, but it takes real-world resources, hardware, software, and electricity to bring more Bitcoin into existence. There will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin, so it has a fixed supply. You can't quite even say that about real estate and gold. A hard cap, a fixed supply. More than 19 million Bitcoin have already been mined. It's truly scarce. And Bitcoin does have a role. It has some downfalls too, in case the government cracks down on it. I think that's the big risk with Bitcoin. But gold and dollars each have their downfall. It's difficult to transport gold across space due to its weight and its volume and security problems. And then dollars, you can't transmit dollars across time due to inflation. Bitcoin is that one store of value. It's still volatile. It's still got some problems there, but it's the one store of value that you can transport across both space and time. You can't say that about dollars or gold. I'm a real estate guy. Real estate, you know, I think of it, Ken, as real estate is old and slow and analog, and Bitcoin is young and fast and digital. So it is kind of a counterpoint to the real estate with the Bitcoin. But yeah, if you need to build wealth and you don't have it yet, it's really difficult to invest in an asset class outside of real estate. Wealthy people's money either starts out in real estate or it ends up in real estate.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I personally, I'm a big gold guy. I love being able to just throw a couple coins in my pocket and fly to wherever I want, pull them out, and there I got $4,000 or $5,000.
It's something tangible. You can actually look at it. It's nice.
It's kind of nice to have that, you know, and I don't particularly look at it as an investment.
Right.
I look at it more as a hedge, an insurance policy, maybe a hedge against the dollar.
Yeah, it's sort of like money insurance. I agree. And really a lot like an insurance policy, you hope you never have to use.
Right.
It's just like you hope you would never have to sell your gold. It's good money insurance. It's not a wealth builder in my experience. It really just generally tracks inflation over time.
Which is a good thing, by the way, especially now. I think what's interesting is, have you had a chance to look at how much gold the central banks have been buying?
They really have.
So this is a really interesting point before we wrap up. So as you guys might know, central banks are in charge of printing money, basically. Well, other things, but one of those, that's one of them. So, and they're kind of upset at the U.S. dollar right now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the world trades in U.S. dollars and they're sitting on U.S. dollars. And as we inflate and print U.S. dollars, it looks like that a lot of them are buying gold, right? And I would, if, you know, if they're trying to store their value in something that dollars, something other than dollars. I read an article the other day that said that we've been weaponizing the dollar against the rest of the world, right?
Right. So many foreign central banks, China, Russia, and many more, they've really been loading up on gold these past few years. You see more and more international trade agreements, like you alluded to, cutting out the dollar and going through the yuan. You had the war in Ukraine. All these things increased geopolitical uncertainty, and that's why gold was on a tear and went over $2,000 recently.
And then BRICS. BRICS is showing up, you know. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South America, right? So, and South Africa, right? And I think there's 30, 40 countries now I've joined. Something like that.
Yep, there's more and more, and they're not pals of the United States.
No. I don't know if you guys are watching this stuff, but it's something you have to watch. I mean, because your hard earned money is yours, and so you have to be a steward of it. You have to look at this stuff. It's not conspiracy theory stuff. You just need to go out and Google this stuff, and you'll see. I know on Thursday we have which will be tomorrow. Is this coming out Wednesday? Good. Okay. Yeah, last Thursday we did a show on BRICS with Robert Kiyosaki and George Gamet on exactly, you know, is the dollar doomed? I don't know the answer, but I do know that you have to keep your eye on this stuff, right?
Well, I'm glad you bring this up, because one can speculate, one can make projections, But one of the few things that we do know, and this is central to every investment that you make, is that the dollar is going to continue to be debased. At what rate, we just don't know. But there are a few guarantees in life, but that's one thing that's virtually guaranteed. And really everything that we're talking about here hedges you against that. Again, dollars and stocks can easily be printed. We want to stay out of those sorts of things.
And if you can fix your rate while the government debases your dollar, you're winning.
That's a winning formula. For every $1 million in debt you have, with just 5% inflation, you only owe the bank back $950K after 1 year, because wages and prices and everything, salaries, are all higher. And with real estate, it's while your tenant pays all the interest for you while you're enjoying that debasement benefit. It's definitely counterintuitive. Get more debt. Debt's one of my favorite four-letter words.
Well, good. Keith, this has been awesome. So what's the best way people can reach you? I know I listen to your stuff, but I'm not sure everyone knows.
The Get Rich Education podcast and Get Rich Education YouTube channel. Real estate pays you five ways at the same time, just regular buy and hold real estate. And it's actually okay that we didn't get into that, because I made a free course with five videos, one on each of the five ways just regular everyday buy and hold real estate pays. And we're giving that away free right now at getricheducation.com/course. So it's the Get Rich Education podcast and YouTube channel. And again, that free course, Real Estate Pays Five Ways, which really reinforces why real estate is that generational wealth builder, is at getricheducation.com/course.
Awesome. All right, buddy. Well, always great seeing you.
Love catching up, Kit.
Thanks for coming in all the way from Alaska.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Real Estate Strategies Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and let us know what you thought of today's episode. Want to take the next step as a real estate investor? Join our free community and gain access to dozens of beginner courses, blogs, weekly insider updates, and much more. Visit kenmcelroy.com/podcast. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
Any information or advice available on this podcast is intended for educational and general guidance only. Ken McElroy and KenMcElroy.com LLC shall not be liable for any direct, incidental, consequential, indirect, or punitive damages arising out of the access to or use of any of the content available on this podcast. Consult a financial advisor or other wealth management professional before you make an investment of any kind. Although Ken McElroy and his affiliates take all reasonable care to ensure the contents of this podcast are accurate and up to date, all information contained on it is provided as is. Ken McElroy makes no warranties or representations of any kind concerning the accuracy or suitability of the information contained on this podcast. Any links to other websites are provided only as a convenience, and KenMcElroy.com LLC encourages you to read the privacy statements of any third-party websites.